Good evening. A few months ago, I received an invitation to lunch at the American Embassy. Now, at first, I thought this must be a case of mistaken identity, and that they'd asked the wrong person. But then I remembered they don't make mistakes like this. And in any case, they have my fingerprints. So I accepted the invitation and came along to lunch and met a charming crowd of people who said they were planning this festival of the arts and humanities. And while George Mulley outlined his plans for this evening's Evening of American Humor, I started wondering exactly why they'd asked me to be involved in it rather than an American. And then I remembered that I have an American wife. That isn't the kind of thing you can forget for very long. I have also three Anglo-American children and several Shelley Berman records and a Bendix washing machine. And we also have two delightful American neighbors and four charming young American children. And this kind of thing does tend to knock the Englishness out of you. So I, as I say, was sitting there at this lunch while George Mulley was telling me all about the humor that they were going to present of the 18th and the 17th century and the 19th century. And I said, well, I certainly am interested in the 20th century and very enthusiastic about it, but I don't really know much about all this other stuff. Perhaps I could take part in the humor of the 20th century. And there was a rather embarrassing pause, and George mumbled something about a younger man. And I was feverishly trying to think of something to say to keep the conversation going. Anyway, eventually we worked out that I wouldn't have to know anything about the 18th or 19th century, but that he, George Mulley, would go to the British Museum and do a tremendous lot of research and come up with a kind of script from which I would read. And then he also promised to provide a company of actors to read the actual material. And so it is with great pleasure that I introduce first George Mulley's script, which I'm going to read, and because that comes first and is even more important to me than the actors, and also the company of actors. And here they are in the order in which they're coming on. Cullen Maiden. Lance Travers. Jonathan Lynn, Doreen Cannon, and Charles Greenwell. Even then, I wanted even more reassurance, and I suggested that perhaps if an American humorist could be found, it would be an awfully good idea. And by great good fortune, they found someone who is known all over the world, really, as an American humorist. And he's done an enormous number of comic lectures, among other things. Now, he has explained to me that the worst thing you can possibly do to a comic lecturer is give him a build-up before he comes on. He says that sometimes he's been introduced as the funniest man in the world, and, of course, this tends to set up a kind of hostility in the audience. So I'm not going to do that to him. And in any case, he is really the original, I would say, of the cliché. He needs no introduction from me. Donald Ogden Stewart.
There's only one thing that in that charming introduction that was omitted. He married an American wife. I married an English wife. And one of the first things that I learned from her was that the English don't laugh out loud. So I'll understand tonight.
I tend to feel that no women ever laugh at their own husbands, you know.
Could we speak about that
yes,
afterwards?
Yes. Now let's get to 1809, the first bit of sustained comic writing in America, a youthful work by Washington Irving. Diedrich Knickerbocker's History of New York, a comic history of the city during the Dutch domination.
According to the best authorities, The world in which we dwell is a huge, opaque, reflecting, inanimate mass, floating in the vast ethereal ocean of infinite space. Has the form of an orange, being an oblate spheroid, curiously compressed at opposite parts for the insertion of two imaginary poles, which are supposed to penetrate and unite at the center, thus forming an axis on which the mighty orange turns with a regular diurnal revolution. Having thus briefly introduced you to the world and given you some idea of its form and situation, you will naturally be curious to know whence it came and how it was created. And indeed, the clearing up of these points is absolutely essential to my history. Inasmuch as if this world had not been formed, it is more than probable that this renowned island on which is situated the city of New York would never have had an existence.
It was the opinion of certain ancient sages that the earth and the whole system of the universe was the deity himself, a doctrine most strenuously maintained by Xenophanes. Other sages adhered to the mathematical system of squares and triangles, the cube, the pyramid, the sphere, the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the icosahedron, and the dodecahedron.
Nor must we omit to mention the great atomic system taught by old Moschus before the siege of Troy, revived by Democritus of laughing memory, improved by Epicurus, that king of good fellows, and modernized by the fanciful Descartes. But I decline inquiring whether the atoms, of which the earth is said to be composed, are eternal or recent. Until the learned have come to an agreement amongst themselves, I shall content myself with the account handed down to us by Moses, in which I do but follow the example of our ingenious neighbors of Connecticut, who, at their first settlement, proclaimed that the colony should be governed by the laws of God, until they had time to make better.
Well, that's really very like the English humor of the 18th century, isn't it?
Well, yeah. While we're on the subject of humor, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a little bit about tonight. We're going to be in the 18th and the 19th centuries, and I'm probably the only person in this audience that was in the 19th century. But the humor at that time had an entirely different setup. There were no gag writers. There was no television. There was no, wasn't even radio. And humor was something that was read, as I remembered, it was read very quietly. It was quiet humor. There were no jet planes overhead. And, well, I can remember the first humor I heard was in Columbus, Ohio, in what they called in those days the parlor. And Grandfather Ogden would sit under the lamp. We didn't have electricity. It wasn't that we were poor. We were poor. But he would sit under the lamp and read to us from Petroleum V. Nasby and Artemus Ward and so forth. And it was, we laughed. We laughed, but we didn't, it wasn't Bob Hope. There wasn't a computer there just to digress a minute, when I first went out to Hollywood, there was a computer out there. If you wrote a comedy and they had it previewed, there were three or four people from the studio there, and at the end of the comedy, they would present you with the computer result. I mean, there'd be 22 chuckles, 11 wows, three yak yak yaks, and a belly laugh, you see. Well, so in your next picture you had to have five belly laughs. This was the 19th century. This was Grandfather, and we were sitting around in a room badly lighted, but it was funny to us then, and I'm just hoping that tonight you try to recapture in a way that Columbus, Ohio
Well, lighting isn't actually too good. Now, the Puritans, of course. We haven't said anything about the Puritans. They didn't have a sense of humor, did they, at all?
They kept it very quiet.
And they arrived with this sense of humor. They kept quiet, and they met Indians who also had no sense of humor. Is that right?
I'll tell you about the Indians. They had a marvelous sense of humor until they looked at the Puritans.
Well, Washington Irving mentions the Indians in this same History of New York.
All the world knows the lamentable state in which these poor savages were found. Not only deficient in the comforts of life, but, what is still worse, most piteously and unfortunately blind to the miseries of their situation. But no sooner did the benevolent inhabitants of Europe behold this sad condition than they immediately went to work to ameliorate and improve it. They introduced among them gin, rum, brandy, and the other comforts of life. And it is astonishing to read how soon the poor savages learned to estimate those blessings. And the Europeans likewise made known to them 1,000 remedies by which the most inveterate diseases are alleviated and healed. And that they might comprehend the benefits and enjoy the comforts of these medicines, they introduced among them the diseases which they were calculated to cure. By these and a variety of other methods was the condition of these poor savages wonderfully improved. They acquired 1,000 wants of which they had before been ignorant. And as he has most sources of happiness who has most wants to be gratified, they were doubtlessly rendered a much happier race of beings.
...1765, an example of pre-revolutionary American humor. Now, Benjamin Franklin, in a letter to the London Times, you see, the English in these days had the curious feeling that only the best things were produced here, like marmalade and wool and, all kinds of things, like tea, for instance. All this came from England. And the mother country objected strongly if the Americans thought of making their own. And the colonies, they felt, should be a market. They were too inefficient, for instance, to raise sheep. And I've been asked to read this letter, as it's probable that Benjamin Franklin had an English accent.
Dear sir, do not let us suffer ourselves to be amused with such groundless objections. The very tails of the American sheep are so laden with wool that each has a little car or wagon on four little wheels to support and keep it from trailing on the ground. And yet all this is as certainly true as the account said to be from Quebec in all the papers of last week that the inhabitants of Canada are making preparations for a cod and whale fishery this summer in the Upper Lakes. Ignorant people may object that the Upper Lakes are fresh and that the cod and whale are saltwater fish. But let them know, sir, that cod, like other fish, when attacked by their enemies, fly into any water where they can be safest. That whales, when they have a mind to eat cod, pursue them wherever they fly. And that the grand leap of the whale in that chase up the fall of Niagara is esteemed by all who have seen it as one of the finest spectacles in nature.
Sir, do you mind if I smoke a pipe?
Please. Please. Virginia tobacco, I
yeah.
Oh, now, Ben Franklin's epitaph. He wrote this when he was 22. The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here. Food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author. Rather nice, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you mind if I not only smoke a pipe, but top that?
If you can do both at the same time.
Well, this happened in the 30s. There, I was working for a magazine called Vanity Fair, and they got the idea of having epitaphs. So they sent out to Dorothy Parker and Robert Bensley, Ring Lardner, and other people to send in what they would like on their tombstones. And I only remember a couple of them. I remember more, but there's only time for a couple of them. One was Dorothy Parker's, which was, "Here lies Dorothy Parker. Excuse my dust." But the one that won the prize was from the playwright Mark Connelly, which was on his tombstone was to be, "Here lies Mark Connelly, who?"
Any more? They'd like to hear some more if you have some.
No,
sure.
I'm softly. I'm out of epitaphs.
Now, moving on to the 1830s and the emergence of the professional American humorist, regional types, frontier humor, down east humor. That's New England, isn't it? Down
That's
east.
Right. Yes.
Seba Smith, editor of Maine's first daily newspaper, wrote a series of letters signed Major Jack Downing. I've read one. Now it's your turn. British fair play.
This is a letter which is dated January 18th, 1830, Portland. And it's to Cousin Ephraim Downing up in Downingville. "Dear Cousin Ephraim, I now take my pen in hand to let you know that I am well, hoping these few lines will find you enjoying the same blessing. When I come down to Portland, I didn't think of staying more than 3 or 4 days if I could sell my load of axe handles and mother's cheeses. But when I got here, I found Uncle Nat had gone a-freightin' down to Quaddy, and Aunt Sally said as how I shouldn't stir a step home till he come back again, which won't be this month. So here I am, lortin' about this great town, lazy as an ox. I've been here now a whole fortnight, and if I would tell you one half I've seen, I guess you'd stare worse than if you'd seen a catamount. I've been to a meeting, and I've been to a museum, and to both the legislators, the one they call the House and the one they call the Senate. They kept disputing most of the time the first 2 days about a poor Mr. Roberts from Waterboro. Some said he shouldn't have a seat because he'd adjourned the town meeting and wasn't fairly elected. And others said it was no such thing, that he was elected as fair as any of them. And Mr. Roberts himself said he was, and said he could bring men that would swear to it, and good men too. But notwithstanding all this, when they come to vote, they got 3 or 4 majority they shouldn't have a seat. And I thought it was a needless piece of cruelty, for they weren't crowded. There was a number of seats in the House empty. But they couldn't have it so, and the poor man had to go and stand up in the lobby. I remain your loving cousin till death, Jack Downing."
Now, these papers of Major Downing were extremely popular for a good 20 years. A drawing of Jack Downing represented the United States in cartoons for many years, and the costume of Uncle Sam still derives from Jack's apparel. Is that true?
If you believe it, it's true. I mean, it's actually true. Mm.
Now, that was Yankee or Down East humor. That's the humor of Major Downing's. Meanwhile, out west, frontier legends produced Davy Crockett, master of exaggeration. Now, David Crockett did exist, didn't he? He was a genuine backwoodsman from Tennessee. He became a congressman and died defending the Alamo. Now, you've heard of the Alamo.
Well, John Wayne's Alamo.
Well, at first, the Crockett stories were political campaign stories, developing a popular hero. Here is one dated 1833, in which he describes his unique method of hunting raccoons, or coons, as the frontiersmen called them.
"I discovered long ago that a coon couldn't stand my grin. I could grin away at one and bring him tumbling from the highest tree. I almost never wasted powder and lead when I wanted one of the critters. Well, one night I was walking about 100 yards from the cabin, just looking around. I saw a coon planted on one of the highest limbs of an old tree. Night was very moony and clear. And I thought I'd bring him down, as usual, with a grin. So I set myself. After grinning at him the usual time, found he didn't come down. Wondered what was the reason. And I took another steady grin at him. He was still there. It made me a little mad, so I looked around, got myself an old branch about 5 feet long, planted one end of the ground, put my chin on the other end. Then I grinned my best for about 5 minutes. Cussed coon still hung on. So, seeing I couldn't bring him down by grinning, I was more determined than ever to get him, because I thought, he must be an unusual coon. Went back to the cabin, got an axe, came back to the tree, saw the coon was still there, and began to chop away. Down came the tree. I rushed forward. Well, coon wasn't to be seen anywhere. Then I discovered that what I'd taken for one was nothing but a big bump on the tree with two knot holes in it. I took some pleasure in seeing that I had grinned all the bark off the tree and left the bump smooth as a mirror. But I still felt tolerable foolish.
...1845. Southwest humor developed further with The Adventures of Simon Suggs by Johnson J. Hooper, a notable contribution to the literature of roguery. Simon's motto was, "It is good to be shifty in a new country." This was Alabama.
Simon becomes captain. It was on Sunday that the alarm was sounded in the Suggs settlement, and most of the neighbors were in attendance upon the preaching of the word by Brother Snuffle-Nosey at Poplar Spring Meeting House, when the runner who brought the woeful tidings disclosed them by yelling as he sat on his horse before the door, "The engines is a-killing everybody below. I ain't got time to stop." Then went up to heaven the screams of 50 frightened women in one vast discord, more dreadful than the war squalls of 100 cats in fiercest battle. Men, too, looked pale and trembled, while, strange to relate, all of the dozen young babies in attendance silently dilated their astonished eyes, struck utterly dumb at being so signally beaten at their own peculiar game. At length, an understanding was somehow effected. The tailor's store should be the place of rendezvous. Simon was duly at the store with his family when the wagon, cart and pony loads of badly scared mortality began to arrive in the afternoon, and he was in his element. Not that Suggs is particularly fond of danger, albeit he is a hero, but because he was well informed as to the state of feeling of the Indians in all the country for 10 miles around, and knew there was no danger. But Simon did not disclose this to the terrified throng at the store, not he.
"Gentlemen, this here is a critical time. The wild savages of the forest are beginning of a bloody hostile war which they ain't about to spare neither age nor sex, not even to the women or children."
"Gracious Lord above, what is a body to do?"
exclaimed the portly widow Haycock. Simon stooped to draw a glass of whiskey from a barrel of that article, the only thing on sale in the store.
"That's the question. Now as for you women folks..."
Here Suggs dropped a lump of brown sugar in his whiskey and began to stir it with his finger, looking intently in the tumbler, the
"It's
while..."
"It's plain enough what you've got to do."
Here Simon tasted the liquor and added a little more sugar.
"Plain enough. You've only got to look to the Lord and hold your jaws, for that's all you can do. But what's the responsible men of this here crowd to do? My opinion, folks, is this here. We ought to form a company right away and make some man, some responsible man, captain. That ain't afeard to fight. Now mind what I say, that ain't afeard to fight. Some sober, steady fella.
Here he sipped a little from the tumbler.
That's a good hand to manage women and keep them from hollering. And more than all, a fella that knows the country and the ways of the Indians.
Having thus spoken, Suggs drank off the rest of the whiskey, threw himself into a military attitude, and awaited a reply. Suggs is the man! Suggs! 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 Shouted a score and a half of masculine voices. The women said nothing, only frowned. A smile of gratified but subdued pride played about Simon's mouth.
Gentlemen, my respects. Ladies, same to you. I'm more than proud to serve my country at the head of such an independent and patriotic company. Let who will run, gentlemen. Simon Suggs will always be found there stuck tight, just like a tick under a cow's belly. Oh, yes, gentlemen, oh, yes. This is storehouse. 2 acres all round is now under martial law. And any man or woman that don't mind my orders, I'll have shot right away. And children to be whipped according to size. By order of me, Simon Suggs, captain of the Tallapoosa Volunteers.
Thus was formed the nucleus of that renowned band of patriot soldiers, afterwards known as the 40 Thieves. A name in the highest degree inappropriate, inasmuch as the company never had upon its roll at any time a greater number of names than 39.
Oh, this is the moment when last night we had an alarm bell, or several alarm bells we heard ringing, and it was a very pleasant diversion. I rather miss that, don't you?
Don't you hear it?
I asked an official today exactly what it meant, and he explained that the little team of Marines at the front entrance have to remain in contact with all the other Marines who are constantly patrolling the building, night and day. And so I said, my word, and what on earth happened at 8:15, last night? And he said, oh, coffee arrived. Well, I hope they're not going without it tonight. The literary comedians. Robert H. Newell was one of the first of this group who appeared after the Civil War. Their characters were better known than the authors. In Newell's case, it was Orpheus C. Kerr.
Get it? Orpheus C. Kerr.
Orpheus C. Kerr. Yes, yes, see? Orpheus C. Kerr. Now, these pieces usually develop...
Thank you very much.
Near thing.
Like Waterloo.
These pieces usually developed only one character. Generally, a shrewdly illiterate but genial clown, somewhat pretentious, an incredibly bad speller and grammarian, and a skillful metaphor juggler. Office seeker.
Last night, an old innocent from Cattaraugus, who wants a post office and thinks I got some influence with the president, brought 6 big Dutchmen to serenade me. And as soon as I opened the window, he called unanimously for a speech. At this time, an immense crowd, consisting of 2 policemen and a hackman, were drawn to the spot and greeted me with great applause. Feeling that their intentions were honorable, I could not bear to disappoint my fellow citizens. And so I was constrained to make the following speech. Men of America, it is with feelings akin to emotion that I regard this vast assemblage of nature's noblemen and reflect that it comes to do honor to me who have only performed my duty. Gentlemen, my heart is full. As the poet says, the night shall be filled with burglars. And the chaps that infest the day shall pack up their duds like peddlers and carry the spoons away. It seems scarcely 5 minutes ago that this vast and otherwise large country sprung from chaos at the call of Columbus and immediately contracted to produce wooden nutmegs for a foreign shore. It seems but 3 seconds ago that all this beautiful scene was a savage wild and echoed the axe falls of the sanguinary pioneer and the footfalls of the last of the Mohicans. Now, what do I see before me? A numerous assembly of respectable Dutchmen and other Americans, all ready to prove to the world how doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour and gathers beeswax all the day from every opening flower. Men of America, shall these things longer be? That's what I want to know. The majestic shade of Washington listens for an answer, and I intend to send it by mail as soon as I receive it. Fellow citizens, it can no longer be denied that there is treason at our very hearthstones. Treason! Merciful heavens! Come rest in this bosom, my own little dear. The Honorable R.M.T. Hunter is here. I know not, I care not, if jilts in that heart. I but know that I love thee, whatever thou art. And now the question arises, is Morrill's tariff really a benefit to the country? Gentlemen, it would be unbecoming in me to answer this question, and you would be incapable of understanding what I might say on the subject. Let each man ask himself, in Dutch, am I prepared to shoulder my musket if I am drafted, or to procure a reprobate to take my place? In other words, the minstrel returned from the war with insects at large in his hair, and having a tuneful guitar, he sang through his nose to his fare. Such, fellow citizens, is the condition of our unhappy country at present. And as soon as it gets any better, I will let you know. An Indian once asked a white man for a drink of whiskey. No, said the man. You redskins are just ignorant enough to ruin yourselves with liquor. The sachem looked calmly into the eyes of the insulter as he retorted, you say I am ignorant. How can that be when I am a well-read man? And so it is. And so it is, fellow citizens, with this union at present. Although I am not able to show exactly where the parallel is. Therefore, let us then be up and wooing with a heart for any mate, still proposing, still pursuing. Learn to court her and to wait. At the conclusion of this unassuming speech, I was waited upon by a young man who asked me if I did not want to purchase some poetry. He had several yards to sell and warranted it to wash.
Abraham Lincoln. It would be appropriate to include at least one small indication of Lincoln's humor. Very few statesmen have used wit so tellingly or have been regarded so affectionately as humorists. Now I have something here, turn page. Once a New York firm applied to Lincoln some years before he became president for some information as to the financial standing of one of his neighbors. And this was his answer. Yours of the 10th received. First of all, he has a wife and a baby. Together, they ought to be worth $500,000 to any man. Secondly, he has an office in which is a table worth $150 and three chairs worth, say, a dollar. Last of all, there is one in one corner a large rat hole which will bear looking into. Respectfully, A. Lincoln.
Does that mean? Because I've got a Lincoln. There was
Sorry.
All right. Because we in the old Stewart family, there was this tradition of the Lincoln letter that grandmother had. And we'd never seen it, but it would come up every once in a while, grandmother's Lincoln letter, do you see? And we were very impressed. And then after she died, my brother and I sort of went around and investigated, and we found out that it was a letter that grandmother had written to Lincoln.
Now, one of Lincoln's favorite authors was David Ross Locke. For the genius to write these things, Lincoln said, I would gladly give up my office. Locke wrote the Petroleum Vesuvius Nasby stories. A Civil War congressman publicly attributed the overthrow of the rebels to three great forces, the Army, the Republican Party, and the letters of Petroleum V. Nasby. One of the tricks of comic writers at this time, of course, was to indulge in funny spelling. And this, I think, is rather gone out, isn't it? But the Nasby, for instance, one or two examples of his spelling, he spelt henceforth, for instance, H-E-N-Z, the numeral four, T-H. And he spelt the word wife, Y-P-H.
Okay. That was 1830.
Yes, quite. Yes. It makes some of these things rather hard reading these days, Ted. Here is one of Nasby's letters.
Mankind is the most perverse and unreasonable beings of the human family. Now, while they will assent to a principle, they never will put it into practice if it bears hard onto them as individuals, to wit. Now, I had been for several weeks delivering a course of lectures upon the divinity of slavery. I argued that the institution was based upon the inferiority of one man to another, and that it was not only wise, but a beautiful provision of nature that the strong should have charge of the weak, a guiding and a protecting and a working of them. Well, the idea pleased my congregation and vastly, and 15 or 20 of the strongest proposed that it should be put into practice, just to show the world that the great doctrine could be carried out just as well in the North as in the South, to which I assented to once, and at the next business meeting, the following plan was adopted. Members of the congregation should try their strength, and them as could lift 600 should own and possess, in fee simple, all them as couldn't. But a trial was had, the division made, and I was happy at being the humble instrument of planting this great institution on northern soil. But alas, owing to the perversity of the human mind, foresaid, it didn't work. Old John Podhammer raised his 600 with greatest of ease, while Bill Sniffles, who was working for him, couldn't fetch it. Podhammer went over to Bill's cabin the next morning and says he, William, from this time henceforth and forever, you are my man. As all a slave has is his master's, the $18 I owe you, or that I did owe you before this blessed system was established, I shall keep. And as you have more furniture than befits your lowly condition, I will send a team over tomorrow to take your bureau and bed and stands up to my house. Well, at this juncture, in comes Ms. Sniffles, who can live 600 with old Podhammer on the top of it. And it was no time before she discovered what his business was. Ooh, she turned red in the face. Said she, you're going to take my furniture? Certainly. And we are your slaves? Of course. And you can sell my chillen? Naturally. And you can make me your concubine?
if I wish. You old beast! Shouted the infuriated female chattel, forgetting her normal condition. You sell my babies. You take my furniture, Dratty. I'll give you some of it now. Whereupon she hurled the chair, which laid him prostrate on the floor. And then she picked him up and threw him out the door. Well, it didn't end here. While he was going out the door, old Podhammer had in his hand a patchwork coverlid belonged to Miss Sniffles, and he walked off with it. Whereupon Miss Sniffles had him took up on a charge of stealing. And he was actually tried, found guilty, and sent to jail for 30 days. Now, how can we establish democratic institutions when the courts won't recognize the laws of nature? The experiment for the present has the appearance of a failure.
Now, Artemus Ward. To return to Abraham Lincoln and his love of good comedy, it is told that in 1862 he paused at a cabinet meeting just before submitting to them the final draft of the Emancipation Proclamation and read to that august group one of Artemus Ward's stories called High-Handed Outrage at Utica. Artemus Ward was the creation of Charles Farrar Brown, who wrote humorous pieces for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Ward was an itinerant showman and lecturer devoted to making a living. In time, Brown himself metamorphosized into Artemus Ward and using that name became an enormously popular comic lecturer. His American success was duplicated in England, both on the stage and in Punch. He died only 33 years old.
33 years old. Yeah. It is said that good humorists die young.
Well, here is the opening of his London lecture delivered at the Egyptian Hall, Piccadilly, in 1866. His subject was Utah and the Mormon faith. He stood before a large screen which rolled transversely behind him, bearing colorful illustrations for his lecture. Donald Ogden Stewart.
You are entirely welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to my little picture shop. I couldn't give you a very clear idea of the Mormons and Utah and the plains and the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, without opening a picture shop. Therefore, I open one. I don't expect to do great things here, but I have thought that if I could make money enough to buy me a passage to New Zealand, I should feel I had not lived in vain. I don't want to live in vain. I'd rather live in Margate or here. But I wish when the Egyptians built this hall, they'd given it a little more ventilation. If you should be dissatisfied with anything here tonight, I will admit you all free to New Zealand. If you will come to me there for the orders. Any respectable cannibal will tell you where I live. This shows I have a forgiving spirit. I really don't care for money. I only travel around to see the world and exhibit my clothes. These clothes I have on were a great success in America. And yet, how often do large fortunes ruin young men? I should like to be ruined, but I can't get on very well as I am. I'm not an artist. I don't paint myself, though perhaps if I were a middle-aged single lady, I should. Yet I have a passion for pictures, photographs, taken of myself. Some of them are very pretty, rather sweet to look at for a short time. And as I said before, I like them. I've always loved pictures. I could draw on wood at a very tender age. When a mere child, I once drew a small cartload of raw turnips over a wooden bridge. The people of the village noticed me. I drew their attention. They said I had a future before me. Up to that time, I had an idea it was behind me. Time passed on. It always does, by the way. You may possibly have noticed that time passes on. It's a kind of a way time has. I became a man. I haven't distinguished myself at all as an artist, but I have always been more or less mixed up with art. I have an uncle who takes photographs, and I have a servant who takes anything he can get his hands on. When I was in Rome in New York State, I mean, a distinguished sculptist wanted to sculpt me, but I said no. I saw through the designing man. My model, once in his hands, he would have flooded the market with my busts, and I couldn't stand to see everybody going around with a bust of me. Everybody would want one, of course, and wherever I should go, I'd meet the educated classes with my bust, taking it home to their families. This would be more than my modesty could stand. And I should have to return to America, where my creditors are. I like art. I admire dramatic art, although I failed as an actor. It was in my schoolboy days that I failed as an actor. The play was The Ruins of Pompeii. I played the ruins. It was not a very successful performance, but it was better than The Burning Mountain. He was no good at all. Remembrances like that often make me ask, where are the boys of my youth? I assure you, this is not a conundrum. Some of the boys of my youth are amongst you here. Some are in America. Some are in jail. And hence arises a most touching question. Where are the girls of my youth? Some are married. Some would like to be. Oh, my Maria. Alas, she married another. They frequently do. But I hope she is happy, because I am. Some people are not happy. I've noticed that. A gentleman friend of mine came to me one day with tears in his eyes, and I said, why these weeps? He said he had a mortgage on his farm, and he wanted to borrow £200. I lent him the money, and he went away. Sometime after, he returned with more tears. He said he must leave me forever. I ventured to remind him of the £200 he'd borrowed, and he was much cut up. I thought I would not be too hard upon him, so I told him I would throw off £100. He brightened and shook my hand and said, old friend, I won't allow you to outdo me in liberality. I'll throw off the other 100. This story hasn't anything to do with my entertainment. I know, but one of the principal features of my entertainment is that it contains so many things that don't have anything to do with it. I like music, but I can't sing. As a singist, I'm not a success. I am saddest when I sing. The other night, some silver-voiced young man came under my window and sang, come where my love lies dreaming. I didn't go. I didn't think it would be correct. I found music very soothing when I lay ill with fever in Utah, and I was very ill. I was fearfully wasted. And on those dismal days, a Mormon lady She was married, though not so much so as her husband. He had 15 other wives. She used to sing a ballad commencing, "Sweet bird, do not fly away." And I told her I wouldn't. She played the accordion divinely. And I met a man in Oregon who hadn't any teeth, not a tooth in his head. Yet that man could play on the bass drum better than any man I ever met. It says here, wait for applause and then announce an intermission. It says here, wait for applause.
Appreciated in London was Bret Harte. England was hungry for indigenous American literature, and Bret Harte satisfied that appetite with Pike dialect stories of the mining camps. He was actually a New York dandy, this Bret Harte, who wrote the Pike stuff. Although he had considerable experience in the West, he also turned his hand to parody, and England may be considered the subject in this treatment of Disraeli's Lothair.
Lothair, or The Adventures of a Young Gentleman in Search of a Religion.
I remember him well as a little boy,
said the Duchess.
His mother was a dear friend of mine, you know. She was one of my bridesmaids.
And you have never seen him since, Mama?
Asked the Lady Coriander, who did not look a day older than her mother.
Never. He was an orphan. He was an orphan shortly after. I've often reproached myself, but it's so difficult to see boys.
This simple yet first-class conversation existed in the morning room of Plushem, where the mistress of the palatial mansion sat involved in the sacred privacy of a circle of her married daughters. The daughters, with one exception, were all married to the highest nobles in the land. That exception was the Lady Coriander, who, there being no vacancy above a marquis or a rental of £1,000,000, waited. Gathered round the refined and sacred circle of their breakfast table, with their glittering coronets, which, in filial respect to their father's Tory instinct and their mother's ritualistic tastes, they always wore on their regal brows, the effect was dazzling as it was refined. It was this peculiarity and their strong family resemblance which led their brother-in-law, the good-humored St. Adelgord, to say,
"Upon my soul, you know, how precious mob look like a ghastly pack of court cards."
Thanks, man.
St. Adelgord was a radical. Having a rent roll of £15,000,000 and coming from one of the oldest families in Britain, he could afford to be.
"Mama, I've just dropped a pearl,"
said the Lady Coriander, bending over the Persian hearth rug.
"From your lips, sweet friend,"
said Lothair, who came of age and entered the room at the same moment.
"No, from my work. It was a very valuable pearl, Mama. Papa gave Isaacs and Sons 50,000 for it."
"Ah, indeed,"
said the Duchess, languidly rising.
"Let us go to luncheon."
"But your grace,"
interposed Lothair, who was still quite young, and had dropped on all fours on the carpet in search of the missing gem.
"Consider the value."
"Dear friend,"
interposed the Duchess with infinite tact, gently lifting him by the tails of his dress coat.
"I am waiting for your arm."
Mr. Putney Padwick's was Lothair's first grand dinner party. Yet, by carefully watching the others, he managed to acquit himself most creditably and avoided drinking out of the finger bowls by first secretly tasting its contents with a spoon. The conversation was peculiar and singularly interesting.
"Then you think that monogamy is simply a question of the thermometer?"
"I certainly think that polygamy should be limited by isothermal lines."
"I should say it was a matter of latitude."
Suddenly, there was a sensation in the room. Among the females, it amounted absolutely to a nervous thrill. His Eminence, the Cardinal, was announced. He entered with great suavity of manner, and after shaking hands with everybody, asking after their relatives, and chucking the more delicate females under the chin with a high-bred grace peculiar to his profession, he sat down.
And how do we all find ourselves this evening, my dears?
He said in several different languages. All of which he, of course, spoke fluently. Lothar's heart was touched. He instantly went up to this gifted being, confessed, and received absolution. As he turned to leave the cardinal, he was struck by a beautiful face. It was that of a matron, slim, but shapely as an Ionic column. Her face was Grecian with Corinthian temples. Hellenic eyes that looked from jutting eyebrows like dormer windows upon an Attic forehead completed her perfect Athenian outline. She wore a black frock coat tightly buttoned over her bloomer trousers and a standing collar.
Your lordship is struck by that face.
I am. Who is she?
Her name is Mary Ann. She is married to an American and has lately invented a new religion.
And thus Lothar was launched on the road to religion and love. Americans delighted in satirizing the English aristocracy. But an aristocracy of sorts was developing in the United States. One of its Brahmins was Oliver Wendell Holmes. Holmes, a doctor, humorist, and philosopher, also wrote light verse. And here is the Ballad of the Oysterman.
There was a tall young oysterman lived by the riverside. His shop was just upon the bank. His boat was on the tide. The daughter of a fisherman that was so straight and slim lived over on the other bank, right opposite to him. It was the pensive oysterman that saw a lively maid upon a moonlight evening, a-sitting in the shade. He saw her wave her handkerchief as much as if to say, I'm wide awake, young oysterman, and all the folks away. Then up arose the oysterman, and to himself said he, I guess I'll leave the skiff at home for fear that folks should see. I read it in the storybook that for to kiss his dear, Leander swam the Hellespont, and I will swim this here. And he has leaped into the waves and crossed the shining stream, and he has clambered up the bank all in the moonlight gleam. Oh, there were kisses sweet as dew and words as soft as rain. But they have heard her father's step, and in he leaps again. Out spoke the ancient fisherman. Now what was that, my daughter? 'Twas nothing but a pebble, sir, I threw into the water. And what is that, pray tell me, love, that paddles off so fast? It's nothing but a porpoise, sir, that's been a-swimming past. Out spoke the ancient fisherman. Now bring me my harpoon. I'll get into my fishing boat and fix the fella soon. Down fell that pretty innocent, as falls a snow-white lamb. Her hair drooped round her pallid cheeks, like seaweed on a clam. Alas for those two living ones. She waked not from her swound, and he was taken with the cramp, and in the waves was drowned. But fate has metamorphosed them in pity of their woe, and now they keep an oyster shop for mermaids down below.
Josh Billings, the fictional persona of Henry Wheeler Shaw, defined American humor vis-a-vis the British in a piece called Americans.
Americans love caustic things. They would prefer turpentine to cologne water, if they had to drink either. So with their relish of humor. They must have it on the half show with cayenne. An Englishman wants his fun smothered deep in mint sauce, and he is willing to wait till the next day before he tastes it. If you tickle or convince an American, you have got to do it quick. An American loves to laugh, but he don't love to make a business of it. He works, eats, and haw-haws on the counter. I guess the English have more wit, and the Americans more humor. We haven't had time yet to boil down our humor and get the wit out of it. The Englishmen are better punsters, but I consider punning a sort of literary prostitution in which future happiness is swapped off for the pleasure of the moment. There is one thing I have noticed. Everybody that writes expects to be wise or witty. So does everybody expect to be saved when they die. But there is good reason to believe that the goats hereafter will be in the majority, just as the sheep are here. Englishmen all laugh at us for our sensations, and some of them fret about it and spread their feathers in distress for us, as an old and foolish old hen will stand on the banks of a mill pond, wringing her hands in agony to see her brood pitch in and take a sail. She can't understand it, but the ducks know all about it. You can bet $50 that the ducks know all about it. You can bet $50 more that it makes no difference who hatches out an American. The first thing he'll do is to pitch into something. No more bets at present.
Now, everything written in this varied course of American humor until the 1860s reached its climax in Mark Twain. Like his great river, the Mississippi, Mark Twain is the sum of many streams and a mighty expanse. Donald Ogden Stewart.
These are the facts concerning my recent resignation. I have resigned. The government appears to go on much the same, but there is a spoke out of its wheel, nevertheless. I was clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology, and I have thrown up my position. I could see the plainest disposition on the parts of the other members of the government to debar me from having any voice in the councils of the nation, and so I could no longer hold office and retain my self-respect. If I were to detail all the outrages that were heaped upon me during the 6 days that I was connected with the government in an official capacity, the narrative would fill a volume. They appointed me clerk of that committee on conchology and then allowed me no amanuensis to play billiards with. I would have borne that, lonesome as it was, if I had met with that courtesy from the other members of the cabinet, which was my due. But I did not. Whenever I observed that the head of a department was pursuing a wrong course, I laid down everything and went and tried to set him right, as it was my duty to do. And I was never thanked for it in a single instance. I went with the best intentions in the world to the Secretary of War, who was not inclined to see me at all until he learned that I was connected with the government. If I had not been on important business, I suppose I could not have got in. I began by asking him for a light. He was smoking at the time. And then I told him I had no fault to find with his defending the parole stipulations of General Lee and his comrades in arms, but that I could not approve of his method of fighting the Indians on the plains. I said he fought too scattering. He ought to get the Indians more together. get them together in some convenient place where he could have provisions enough for both parties and then have a general massacre. I said there was nothing so convincing to an Indian as a general massacre. If he could not approve of the massacre, I said the next surest thing for an Indian was soap and education. Soap and education are not as sudden as a massacre, but they are more deadly in the long run. Because a half-massacred Indian may recover, but if you educate him and wash him, it's bound to finish him sometime or other. It undermines his constitution. It strikes at the foundation of his being. Sir, I said, the time has come when blood-curdling cruelty has become necessary. Inflict soap and a spelling book on every Indian that ravages the plains, and let them die. The Secretary of War asked me if I was a member of the cabinet, and I said I was. He inquired what position I held, and I said I was clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology. I was then ordered under arrest for contempt of court and restrained of my liberty for the best part of the day. And I almost resolved to be silent thenceforward and let the government get along the best way it could. But duty called, and I obeyed. My next visit was to the Secretary of the Treasury, and he said, "What will you have?" The question threw me off my guard, and I said, "Rum punch." He said, "If you have got any business here, sir, state it, and in as few words as possible." I then said that I was sorry he had seen fit to change the subject so abruptly, because such conduct was very offensive to me. But under the circumstances, I would overlook the matter and come to the point. And I now went into an earnest expostulation with him upon the extravagant length of his report. I said it was expensive, unnecessary, and awkwardly constructed. There were no descriptive passages in his report, no poetry, no sentiment, no heroes, no plot, no pictures, not even woodcuts. Nobody would read it. That was a clear case. I urged him not to ruin his reputation by getting out a thing like that. If he ever hoped to succeed in literature, he must throw more variety into his writings. He must beware of dry details. I said that the main popularity of the almanac was derived from its poetry and its conundrums, and that a few conundrums distributed around through the Treasury report would help the sale of it more than all the internal revenue he could put into it. And I said these things in the kindest spirit, and yet the Secretary of the Treasury fell into a violent passion. He even said that I was an ass. He abused me in the most vindictive manner and said that if I came there again, meddling with his business, he would throw me out the window. I said I would take my hat and go if I could not be treated with the respect due to my office, and I did go. It was just like a new author. They always think they know more than anybody else when they're getting out their first book, and nobody can tell a new author anything. Well, I never attended one cabinet meeting while I was connected with the government, and that was sufficient for me. The servant at the White House door did not seem disposed to make way for me until I asked if the other members of the cabinet had arrived. He said they had, and I entered, and they were all there. but nobody offered me a seat. They stared at me as if I'd been an intruder, and the president said, "Well, sir, who are you?" I handed him my card, and he read out loud, "The Honorable Mark Twain, Clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology." Then he looked at me from head to foot as if he'd never heard of me before. The Secretary of the Treasury said, "This is the meddlesome ass that came to recommend me to put poetry and conundrums in my report, as if it were an almanac." And the Secretary of War said, "It's the same visionary that came to see me yesterday with a scheme to educate a portion of the Indians to death and massacre the balance." Well, I said, "Gentlemen, I perceive here a disposition to throw discredit upon every act of my official career. I perceive also a disposition to debar me from all voice in the councils of the nation. No notice whatever was sent to me today. It was only by the merest chance that I learned that there was going to be a cabinet meeting. But let these things pass. All I wish to know is this a cabinet meeting or is it not?" The president said that it was. "Then," I said to the president, "let us proceed to business at once and not fritter away valuable time in unbecoming fault findings with each other's official conduct." The Secretary of State now spoke up in his benignant way and said, "Young man, you are laboring under a mistake. The clerks of the congressional committees are not members of the cabinet. Neither are the doorkeepers of the cabinet, strange as that may seem. Therefore, much as we could desire your more than human wisdom in our deliberations, we cannot lawfully avail ourselves of it. The councils of the nation must proceed without you. If disaster follows, as follow full it well may, be it balm to your sorrowing spirit that by deed and voice you did what in you lay to avert it. You have my blessing. Farewell." These gentle words soothed my troubled breast and I went away. But the servants of a nation know no peace. I had hardly reached my den in the Capitol and disposed my feet on the table like a representative, when one of the senators on the Conchological Committee came in a passion and said, "Where have you been all day?" I observed that, if that was anybody's affair but my own, I had been to a cabinet meeting. "To a cabinet meeting? I'd like to know what business you had at a cabinet meeting." I said I went there to consult, allowing for the sake of argument that he was in any wise concerned in the matter. He grew insolent then and ended by saying he had wanted me for 3 days past to copy a report on bombshells, eggshells, clamshells, and I don't know what all, connected with conchology. And nobody had been able to find me. And this was too much. This was the feather that broke the clerical camel's back. I said, "Sir, do you suppose that I'm going to work for $6 a day? If that is the idea, let me recommend the Senate Committee on Conchology to hire somebody else. I am the slave of no faction. Take back your degrading commission. Give me liberty or give me death." From that hour, I was no longer connected with the government. Snubbed by the department, snubbed by the cabinet, snubbed at last by the chairman of the committee I was endeavoring to adorn, I yielded to persecution, cast far from me the perils and seductions of my great office, and forsook my bleeding country in the hour of her peril. But I had done the state some service, and I sent in my bill. "To the United States of America, in account with the Honorable Clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology, debtor. To consultation with the Secretary of War, $50. To consultation with Secretary of Treasury, $50. Cabinet consultation, no charge. To mileage to and from Jerusalem, Missouri, via Egypt, Algiers, Gibraltar, and Cadiz, 14,000 miles at 20 cents a mile, $2,800. To salary as clerk of Senate Committee on Conchology, 6 days at $6 per day, $36. Total, $2,986. Not an item of this bill has been paid, except that trifle of $36 for salary. The Secretary of the Treasury, pursuing me to the last, drew his pen through all the other items and simply marked in the margin, not allowed. So the dread alternative is embraced at last. Repudiation has begun. The nation is lost.
Henry James. When Henry James turned to comedy, his subject, naturally enough, was his fellow Americans. He returned to the United States in 1881 after an absence of 6 years and wrote, "I didn't much care for it at first, but it improves immensely on acquaintance. And after you've got the right point of view and diapason, it is a wonderfully entertaining and amusing country." He wrote a short story on this theme, The Point of View, a series of letters which present a multiple view of the United States. Here are some extracts.
From Miss Aurora Church at sea to Miss Whiteside in Paris, September 1880. We've been for the last 3 hours in sight of land and are soon to enter the Bay of New York, which is said to be exquisitely beautiful. I find I don't remember anything, for my recollections of our voyage to Europe so many years ago are exceedingly dim. Mama's been very poorly. She says, however, that it isn't the being at sea. It's on the contrary, approaching the land. She's not in a hurry to arrive. She keeps well before her that great disillusions await us. I heard her say yesterday to an English gentleman, a very odd Mr. Antrobus, the only person with whom she converses, that she was afraid she shouldn't like her native land, and that she shouldn't like not liking it. But this is a mistake. She'll like that immensely. I mean the not liking it. Mr. Antrobus, he's a Right Honourable and a Member of Parliament, has written during the voyage about 100 letters and seems greatly alarmed at the number of stamps he'll have to buy when he arrives. He's full of information, but he hasn't enough. How would it be in one of your southwestern states? That's his favourite way of opening a conversation. Fancy me giving an account of one of my southwestern states. I tell him he'd better ask Mama. A little to tease that lady, who knows no more about such places than I.
Mrs. Church in New York to Madame Galapin in Geneva. If I felt far away from you in the middle of that deplorable Atlantic, chère madame, how do I feel now, in the heart of this extraordinary city? We've arrived, dear friend. But I don't know whether to tell you that that's an advantage. We're safe, however. As by which to say we're physically safe, we've taken up the thread of our familiar pension life, but under strikingly different conditions. You know that I've never for a moment remitted my pretensions as an individual. I may occupy a small apartment, a quatrième, but at least I'm a person and have personal rights. And that brings me back to my poor child and her problems. She takes a very critical view of them herself. She tells me I've given her a false education and that no one will marry her because she's too much of a foreigner, and that no foreigner will marry her because she's too much of an American. You'll doubtless be surprised to hear that I've ceased to argue. But it's time I should confess that I've at last agreed to let her act for herself. She's to live for 3 months à l'Americaine, and I am to be a mere passive spectator. You'll feel with me that this is a cruel position for a coeur de mer. I count the days till our 3 months are over, and I know you'll join with me in my prayers.
From the Right Honorable Edward Antrobus, MP, in Boston to the Honorable Mrs. Antrobus, November 1880.
My dear Susan, I sent you a postcard on the 13th and a native newspaper yesterday. I really have had no time to write. I sent you the newspaper because the amusing oddities of expression and the like, some of them are intentional. You'll have heard of the celebrated American humor. Remind me, by the way, on my return to Thistledown, to give you a few of the examples of it that my own experience supplies. Certain other of the journalistic eccentricities I speak of are unconscious and are perhaps on that account the more diverting. Point out to the children the difference. Insofar as you're sure that you yourself perceive it. You must excuse me if these lines are not very legible. I'm writing them by the light of a railway lamp which rattles above my left ear, it being only at odd moments that I can find time to extend my personal researches. You'll say this is a very odd moment indeed when I tell you that I'm in bed in a sleeping car. I occupy the upper berth. I will explain to you the arrangement when I return. While the lower forms the couch of an unknown female. Now, you'll be very anxious for my explanation. But I assure you that the circumstance I mention is the custom of the country. I myself am assured that a lady may travel in this manner all over the Union without a loss of consideration. A ventilator is open just over my head and a lively draught mingled with a drizzle of cinders pours in through this dubious advantage. I will describe to you its mechanism on my return. If I had occupied the lower berth, I should have had a whole window to myself, and by drawing back the blind, my safe proceeding at the dead of night, I should have been able, by the light of an extraordinarily brilliant moon, to see a little better what I write. The question occurs to me, however, would the lady below me in that case have ascended to the upper berth? You know my old taste for hypothetic questions. I incline to think, from what I have seen, that she would simply have requested me to evacuate my own couch. The ladies in this country ask for anything they want. Some of the facilities with regard to luggage, the transmission of parcels and the like, are doubtless very useful when thoroughly mastered, but I have not yet succeeded in availing myself of them without disaster. I have sometimes thought it was a great mistake not to bring Plumeridge. He would have been useful indeed for brushing and packing my clothes and getting me my tub. I travel with a large tin one. There are none to be obtained at the inns, and the transport of this receptacle often presents the most insoluble difficulties. It is often, too, an object of considerable embarrassment in arriving at private houses where the servants have less reserve of manner than in England. As I was about to inquire, however, who would get Plumeridge his tub and attend to his little comforts? We couldn't very well make our appearance on arriving for a visit with two of the utensils I've named. Even as regards a single one, I've had the carriage, as I may say, of a lifelong habit. It would hardly be expected that we should both use the same. Though there have been occasions in my travels as to which I see no way of blinking the fact that Plumeridge would have had to sit down to dinner with me. Such a contingency would completely have unnerved him. So that on the whole, it was doubtless the wiser part to leave him respectfully touching his hat on the tender in the Mersey.
From Miss Aurora Church in New York to Miss Whiteside in Paris, January 1881. I told you about my agreement with Mama, that I was to have my liberty for 3 months, and that if at the end of this time I shouldn't have made a good use of it, I was to give it back to her. Well, the time's up today, and I'm very much afraid I haven't made any use of it at all. I haven't got married. She came in at this moment to announce that we must push further. She has decided for the West. Oh, wonderful, Mama. It appears that my real chances for a pioneer, they've sometimes millions. But fancy us at Oshkosh.
The turn of the century. As the waves of immigration began to break on American shores, urban humorists saw new opportunity for comedy in the Americanization of these new citizens. German and Irish dialect stories became popular. The editor of the Chicago Journal, Finlay Peter Dunn, wrote Mr. Dooley's Dissertations and managed to discuss Chicago politics in a forthright radical way, which, devoid of its Irish humor, would not have slipped past the newspaper owners.
The vice president. It's a strange thing about the vice presidency. The presidency is the highest office in the gift of the people. The vice presidency is the next highest and the lowest. It isn't a crime exactly. You can't be sent to jail for it, but it's kind of a disgrace. It's like writing anonymous letters. At a convention, nearly all the delegates leave as soon as they've nominated the president for fear one of them will be nominated for vice president. Why is it, I wonder, that everybody runs away from a nomination for vice president as if it was an indictment by the grand jury? It usedn't to be so. In the old days, when the boys had nominated some unknown man from New York for president, they turned in and nominated a great and well-known man from the West for vice president. The candidate for vice president was ordered the ticket we ever see during a campaign. They thought it was an honor. But if you'd read their biographies today, you'd find at the end, the writer will pass over the closing years of Mr. Thurman's career hurriedly. It is enough to say of this painful period that after a lifetime of devoted service to his country, the statesman's declining days was clouded by a great sorrow. He became Vice President of the United States. Oh, how much better 'twere that we should be sawed off early by the great Reaper Death than that a life of honor should end in ignominy. It's a terrible thing. If you say about a man that he's good presidential timber, he'll buy you a drink. If you say he's good vice presidential timber, you mean he isn't good enough to be cut up into shingles and you'd better be careful. It's strange too, because it's a good job. I should think a man could put in 4 years comfortably in the place if he was a sound sleeper. What are his duties, says ye? Well, during the campaign, he has to do a good deal of the rough outside work. The candidate for president is at home picking out the big words in the dictionary and firing them at us from time to time. The candidate for the vice presidency is out in Iowa, yelling from the back of a car or a dray. He goes to all the church fairs and wakes and appears at public meetings between a cornet solo and the glee club. Yes, sir, the candidate for vice president has a busy time of it during the campaign. Hopping from town to town, speaking, shaking hands with the populace who call him Hal or Charlie, dodging bricks, fighting with his audience, and digging up for the finance committee. He has to be an all-round man. He must be a good speaker, a pleasant man with the ladies, a fair boxer and wrestler, something of a liar, And if he's a Republican, campaigning in Texas, an active sprinter. If he has all them qualities, he may or may not receive a majority at the polls, and no one will know whether they voted for him or not. Well, he's elected. The electors call on the candidate for president and hand him the office. They notify the candidate for vice president through the personal columns of the papers. If the tall, dark gentleman with hazel eyes, black coat and a white vest, who is nominated at the convention for vice president, will call at headquarters, he will hear of something to his advantage. So, he buys a ticket and hops to Washington, where he gets a good room suited to his station, right above the kitchen and overlooking a woodyard. Every morning, it is his business to call at the White House and inquire after the president's health. When told that the president was never better, he gives three cheers and departs with a heavy heart. The feeling of the vice president about the president's well-being is very deep. If the president has a touch of fever, the vice president gets a touch of the fever himself. He has the doctor on the phone during the night. "Doc, I hear the president is unwell," he says. "Can I do anything for him? Like a draw on his salary or appointing a postmaster at Indianapolis?" It is principally because of the vice president that most of our presidents have enjoyed such rugged health. The vice president guards the president, and the president, after sizing up the vice president, concludes that it would be better for the country if he should yet live a while. "Do you know," says the president to the vice president, "every time I see you, I feel 10 years younger." "Your kind words," says the vice president to the president, "brings tears to me eyes. My wife was saying only this morning how comfortable we are in our little flat." Some vice presidents have been so anxious for the president's safety that they've had to be warned off the White House grounds. Now, aside from the arduous duties of looking after the president's health, it is the business of the vice president to preside over the deliberations of the Senate. It is his duty to rigorously enforce the rules of the Senate. There are none. The Senate is ruled by courtesy, like the Longshoremen's Union. The vice president is not expected to butt in much. It would be a breach of senatorial courtesy for him to step down and pat the senator from Texas and the senator from Indiana in the middle of a debate under a desk on whether northern gentlemen were more gentlemanly than southern gentlemen. I shouldn't wonder if he tried to do it, if he was taught his place with the leg of a chair. He isn't even called upon to give a decision. All that his grateful country demands from the man that she's elevated to this proud position on the toe of her boot is that he shall keep his opinions to himself. So he whiles away the pleasant hours in the beautiful city of Washington. And when he wakes up, he is either in the White House or on the street. I'll never say anything against the vice presidency. It's a good job and is richly deserved by either of the candidates. And be heavens, I'll go further and say that it richly deserves either of them.
Well, that brings us to the 20th century. And it's my pleasure to tell you that on the 19th and 20th, there'll be another program dealing with Thurber and Perelman and all, Donald Ogden Stewart and all the others of this modern period. Now, before you return to British soil, I think it would be appropriate if you just kind of put your hands together as a kind of tribute to Mark Twain and Artemus Ward and all these other wonderful humorists of this period, and also for George Mulley, who is responsible for introducing them to you this evening.